Maybe I'd check him out too, as long as I was at it. I went into the condominium courtyard. Chapter 7. I found Tilly spraying down the walk, a rolling tumble of leaves and debris pushed along by the force of the jet. Water dripped from the feather palms, the rubbery scent of hose mingling with the odor of wet earth. Stepping stones were tucked in among the giant ferns, though why anyone would want to walk back in there was beyond me. It looked like a shadowy haven for Daddy Longlegs. Tilly smiled when she saw me and released the trigger nozzle, shutting off the spray. She was wearing jeans and a t-shirt, her spare form giving her a girlish look even in her 60s. "Did you ever get any sleep?" I asked. "No, and I'm not going to stay in that apartment till the windows are fixed. I may have an alarm system put in, too. I came out here just to busy myself. Hosing the walks is restful, don't you think? It's one of the pleasures of adulthood. When I was a kid, my dad never would let me have a turn."
"Have you been down to the police station yet?"
"Oh, I'll go in a bit, but I don't look forward to it."
"I went by a little while ago and filed a missing persons report on Elaine."
"What did they say?"
I shrugged. "Nothing much. They'll do what they can. I ran into a homicide detective who worked on Marty Grice's murder. He says Elaine was supposed to come in for an interview and never showed up. Do you remember how soon afterward she went to Florida?"
"Well, I'm not sure. It was that same week. I do know that much. She was terribly upset about the murder, and that's one reason she left. I thought I mentioned that."
"You said she was sick."
"She was, but she always seemed to have something wrong with her. She said the murder had her crazy with anxiety. She thought getting out of town would help." "Hang on," Tilly said.
She went into the bushes and turned off the water at the faucet, using the last of the water pressure to empty the hose before she coiled it up again. She emerged from the shrubbery, wiping her damp hands on her jeans.
"Are you thinking she knew something about Marty's death?"
"I think it's worth looking into," I said. "Her side window looks right down into the Grice's entryway. Maybe she saw the burglar."
Tilly made a skeptical face. "In the dark?"
I shrugged. "It doesn't seem likely, does it? But I don't know what else to think."
"But why wouldn't she have gone to the police if she knew who it was?"
"Who knows? Maybe she wasn't thinking straight. People panic. They don't like to get involved in these things. Maybe she felt she was in jeopardy herself."
"Well, she was nervous," Tilly said. "But then we were all a bundle of nerves that week. You want to come in?"
"Actually, I do. I think I ought to take a look at those bills of hers. At least we can see how recently she's used her charge accounts and where she was at the time. Has anything else come in?"
"Just a couple of things. I'll show you what I've got."
I followed Tilly through the lobby and into the corridor beyond. She unlocked her front door and moved into the living room, crossing to the secretary. Since the glass had been broken out of the doors, there was no need to lock anything, but I saw her hesitate, nonplussed, putting an index finger on the side of her cheek, like someone posing for a photograph.
"Now, that's odd."
"What?" I asked. I crossed to the secretary and looked in. We'd replaced the tumble of books the night before, and there was nothing else on the shelves now except a small brass elephant and a framed snapshot of a puppy with a stick in its mouth.
"I don't see Elaine's bills, and they should be there," she said. "Now, isn't that strange?"
She glanced at the shelves again, and then opened the drawers one by one, sorting through the contents. She moved into the kitchen and dug into the big black plastic bag where we had dumped all the broken glass and debris the night before. There was no sign of them.
"Kinsey, they were in the secretary yesterday. I saw them myself. Where could they have gone?"
She looked up at me. It didn't take a massive leap of intelligence to arrive at the obvious possibility.
"Could she have taken them?" Tilly asked. "That woman who broke in last night? Is that what she was really up to?"
"Tilly, I don't know. Something about it bothered me at the time," I said. "It didn't make sense to think someone would break in while you were here just to tear the place apart." "Are you sure you saw them yesterday?"
"Of course. I put the new batch of bills with the other ones on the shelf.
They were right here, and I don't remember seeing them at all when we cleaned up. Do you?
I thought back, chasing it around in my memory. I'd only seen the bills once, the first time I'd talked to her. But why would someone bother to steal them? It didn't make sense. Maybe she deliberately scared the pants off you to keep you out of the way while she searched the place, I said.
Well, she sure had the right idea. I wouldn't have come out of my room on a dare. But why would she do that? I don't understand.
I don't either. I can always get duplicates of the bills, but it's going to be a pain in the ass, and I'd rather not do it if I don't have to.
I want to know who has a key to my apartment. That makes my blood run cold.
I don't blame you. Listen, Tilly, nothing makes me crazier than 16 unanswered questions in a row. I'm going to see what I can find out about this murder next door. It has to be connected somehow. Have you talked to Leonard Grice recently?
Oh, he hasn't been there since it happened, she said. I haven't seen him at any rate.
What about the Snyders on the other side? Do you think they could be of any help?
They might. Do you want me to talk to them?
No, don't worry about it. I'll check with them myself. Just one more thing. Leonard Grice has a nephew, a kid with a pink mohawk.
Mike!
Yeah, him. Is there any chance he might have been the person who broke in last night? I just talked to him outside, and he's not a big guy. He might well have looked like a woman in the dark.
I don't think so, she said, skepticism plain. I couldn't swear to it, but I don't think it was him.
Well, just a thought. I don't like to make assumptions about gender. It really could have been anyone. I'm going to go next door and see what the Snyders have to say. You take care of yourself. The house at 2093 was similar in feeling to the house that burned. The same size lot, same ill proportions, the same white frame and red brick. The brick itself was roughly textured, a cunning imitation of fired clay. There was a for sale sign out front with a banner pasted across it boasting, "Sold," as though an auction had been enacted just before I started up the walk. A large tree shaded the yard down to a chill, and dark ivy choked the trunk, spreading out in all directions in a dense mat that nearly smothered the walk. I went up to the porch steps and knocked on the aluminum screen door. The front door had a big glass panel in it, blocked by a sheer white curtain stretched between two rods. After a moment, someone moved the curtain aside and peered out. "Mr. Snyder?" The curtain was released and the door opened a crack. The man appeared to be in his 70s, corpulent and benign. Old age had given him back his baby fat and the same look of grave curiosity. I held out a business card. "My name is Kinsey Milhone. Could I have a few minutes of your time? I'm trying to track down Elaine Bolt, who lives in that big condominium over there. And Tilly Allberg suggested I talk to you. Can you help me out?" Mr. Snyder released the catch on the screen door.
"I'll do what I can. Come on in."
He held the screen door open, and I followed him inside. The house was as dark as the inside of a soup can, and smelled of cooked celery. From the rear of the house, a shrill voice called out,
"What's that? Who all is out there, Aris?"
"Someone Tilly sent."
"Who?"
"Hold on a minute," he said to me. "She's deaf as a yard of grass. Take a seat."
Mr. Snyder lumbered toward the back. I perched on an upholstered chair with wooden arms. The fabric was a dark maroon plush with a high-low pattern of foliage, some nondescript sort that I'd never seen in real life. The seat was sprung, all hard edges and the smell of dust. There was a matching couch stacked with newspapers and a low mahogany coffee table with an inset of oval glass, barely visible for all the paraphernalia on top. Dog-eared paperbacks, plastic flowers in a ceramic vase shaped like two mice in an upright embrace, a bronze version of praying hands, six pencils with erasers chewed off, pill bottles, and a tumbler that had apparently held hot milk, which had left a lacy pattern on the sides of the glass like baby's breath. There was also an inexplicable pile of pancakes wrapped in cellophane.
I leaned forward, squinting. It was a candle. Mr. Snyder could have moved the entire table outside and called it a yard sale. From the back end of the house, I could hear his exasperated explanation to his wife.
"It's nobody selling anything," he snapped. "It's some woman Tilly sent. Says she's looking for Mrs. Bolt." "Bolt!" "That widow woman lived upstairs of Tilly. The one played cards with Leonard and Martha now and again."
There was a feeble interjection, and then his voice dropped.
"No, you don't need to come out. Just keep set. I'll take care of it."
He reappeared, shaking his head, his jowls flushed. His chest was sunken into his swollen waistline. He'd had to belt his pants below his big belly, and his cuffs drooped at the ankles. He hitched at them irritably, apparently convinced he'd lose them if he didn't hang on. He wore slippers without socks, and all the hair had been worn away from his ankles, which were narrow and white, like soup bones.
"Switch on that light there," he said to me. "She likes to pinch on utilities. Half the time I can't see a thing."
I reached over to the floor lamp and pulled the chain. A 40-watt bulb came on, buzzing faintly, not illuminating much. I could hear a steady thump and shuffling in the hall. Mrs. Snyder appeared, moving a walker in front of her. She was small and frail, and her jaw worked incessantly. She stared intently at the hardwood floor, and her feet made a sticky sound as she walked, as though the floor had been shellacked and had never dried properly. She paused, hanging onto her walker with shaking hands. I stood up, projecting my voice.
"Would you like to sit here?" I asked her.
She surveyed the wall with rheumy eyes, trying to discover the source of the sound. Her head was small, like a little pumpkin off the vine too long, looking shrunken from some interior softening. Her eyes were narrow, inverted V's, and one tooth protruded from her lower gum like a candle wick. She seemed confused.
"What?"
she said, but the question had a hopeless ring to it. I didn't think anybody answered her these days. Snyder waved at me impatiently.
"She's fine. Just leave her be. Doctor wants her on her feet more anyway," he said.
I watched her uncomfortably. She continued to stand there, looking puzzled and dismayed, like a baby who's learned how to pull itself up on the sides of a crib, but hasn't figured out how to sit down again. Mr. Snyder ignored her, settling on the couch with his knees spread. His belly filled the space between his legs like a duffel bag, as cumbersome on him as a clown suit with a false front. He put his hands on his knees, giving me his full attention, as though I might be soliciting his entire history for inclusion on This Is Your Life.
"We've been in this house 40 years, he said. "Bought it back in 1943 for $4,000. Bet you never heard of a house that cheap. Now it's worth $115,000. Just the lot we're sitting on. That don't even count the house. They can knock this place down and build anything they want. Hell, she can't even get that walker into the commode. Now, Leonard next door nearly sold his house for $135,000, had it in escrow and everything, and then the deal fell out. That about done him in. He's the one I feel sorry for. House burnt, wife dead. You know what the kids these days would say. His carnal was bad."
He went right on talking while I took mental notes. This was better than I'd hoped. I had thought I'd have to tell a few fibs, leading the conversation around judiciously from Elaine's whereabouts to the subject of the murder next door. But here sat Horace Snyder, giving testimony extemporaneously. I realized he'd stopped. He was looking at me.
"You've sold this house?"
I saw the sign out front.
"Sold," he said with satisfaction. "We can move us up to that retirement place when the kids get everything here packed up. We've got a regular reservation. We're on the list and everything. She's old. She doesn't even know where she is half the time. Fire broke out in this place, she'd lay there and cook."
I glanced at his wife, who had apparently locked her knees. I was worried she would pass out, but he didn't seem to give it much thought. She might as well have been a hall tree. Snyder went on as though prompted by questions from an unseen audience.
Yes, sir, I sold it. She liked to have a fit, but the house is in my name, and I own it free and clear. Paid $4,000. Now, I called that a profit, wouldn't you?
That's not bad, I said. I glanced over at his wife again. Her legs had begun to tremble.
Why don't you get on back to bed, May? He said,
and then looked at me with a disapproving shake of his head.
She can't hear good. Hearing comes and goes. Got tintypes of the ear, and all she can see is living shapes. She got the leg of that walker hung up on the broom closet door last week, and stood there for 46 minutes before she got loose. Old fool.
You want me to help you get her back to bed? I asked. Snyder floundered on the couch, turning himself sideways so he could get up. He pushed himself to his feet and then went over to her and shouted in her face.
Go lay down a while, May, and then I'll get you some snackin' cake, he said.
She stared steadfastly at his neck, but I could have sworn she knew exactly what he was talking about and was just feeling stubborn and morose.
Why did you put the light on? I thought it was day, she said.
It only costs 5 cents to run that bulb, he said.
What?
I said, it's pitch black night outside and you got to go to bed, he hollered.
Well, she said, I think I might in that case.
Laboriously, she thumped the walker around, navigating with effort. Her eyes slid past me, and she seemed suddenly to discern me in the haze.
Who's that?
It's some woman, Snyder broke in. I was telling her of Leonard's bad luck.
Did you tell her what I heard that night? Tell about the hammering kept me awake. Hanging pictures. Bang, bang, bang. I had to take a pill. It made my head hurt so bad.
That wasn't the same night, May. How many times I told you that? It couldn't have been, because he wasn't home and he's the one did that kind of thing. Burglars don't hang pictures.
He looked over at me then, twirling his index finger beside his temple to indicate that she was rattle-brained.
Banged and bang, she said.
But she was only muttering to herself as she thunked away, moving the walker in front of her like a clothes rack.
She hasn't a faculty left, he said to me over his shoulder. Pees on herself half the time. I had to move every stick of dining-room furniture out and put her bed in there, right where the sideboard stood. I told her I'd outlive her the day I married her. She gets on my nerves. She did back then, too. I'd just as soon live with a side of meat.
Who's at the door?
She said insistently.
Nobody. I'm talking to myself, he said.
He shuffled into the hallway behind her. His hovering had a tender quality about it, in spite of what he said. In any event, she didn't seem aware of his aggravation or his minor tyrannies. I wondered if he'd stood there and timed her for the 46 minutes while she struggled with the broom closet door. Is that what marriages finally come down to? I've seen old couples toddle down the street together, holding hands, and I've always looked on faintly misty-eyed. But maybe it is all the same clash of wills behind closed doors. I've been married twice myself, and both ended in divorce. I berate myself for that sometimes, but now I'm not sure. Maybe I haven't made such a bad trade-off. Personally, I'd rather grow old alone than in the company of anyone I've met so far. I don't experience myself as lonely, incomplete, or unfulfilled, but I don't talk about that much. It seems to piss people off, especially men.
End of Disc 2. Disc 3.
Chapter 8. Mr. Snyder returned to the living room and sat down heavily on the couch.
Now then.
What can you tell me about that fire next door? I asked. I saw the place. It looks awful. He nodded, preparing himself as though for a television interview, staring straight ahead.
Well, now, The fire engine woke me up 10 o'clock at night. Two of 'em. I don't sleep good anyhow, and I heard the siren come right up here close, so I got up and went out. Neighbors was running from every which way. Black smoke out in that house like you never saw. These firemen, they bashed their way in, and pretty soon flames ate up the front porch. Whole backside got saved. They found Marty, that was Leonard's wife, laying on the floor. "It'd be right about over there," he said, pointing toward the front door. I never seen her myself, but Tilly said she was charred, head to foot. Just a bunch of stumps, like a piece of wood.
Oh, really? Tilly didn't mention that to me.
She seen the smoke and called right up. 911 it was. I was sound asleep. Woke up when the fire engine come blasting down the road. I thought they'd go right on by, but then I seen the lights and I got up and put a robe on and went out. Poor Leonard wasn't even home. He drove up about the time they got the fire out. Collapsed right on the street when he heard she was dead. I never saw a man so tore up. My wife May, she never woke up at all. She'd taken a pill, and she's deaf as a broom anyway. You've seen that yourself. Fire broke out here, she'd been roast pork.
What time was it when Mr. Grice got home?
I don't know the exact time. 15-20 minutes after the fire engines come, as best I recollect. He was out to dinner with his sister, as I hear tell, and he comes home to find his own wife dead. His knees give out, and down he went. Right on the sidewalk, with me standin' not this far away. Turned white and dropped like a big hand had given him a thump and knocked him out. It was the awfulest thing you ever saw. They brought her out zipped up in a plastic sack.
How'd Tilly happen to see her? I interrupted. I mean, if she was zipped up in a body bag.
Oh, that Tilly, she sees everything. Ask her. She probably pushed through when the door got bashed in and seen the body for herself. Makes me sick to think of it.
I understand Leonard's been staying with his sister since then.
That's what I heard, too. Her name is Howe. Lives on Carolina. It's in the book if you want to get in touch.
Good. I'll try to see him this afternoon. I'm hoping he can tell me something about where Mrs. Bolt might have gone. I got up and held out my hand. You've been a big help. Mr. Snyder struggled to his feet and shook my hand, walking to the door with me. I looked over at him with curiosity. What do you think your wife was referring to when she mentioned the hammering that night? Do you have any idea what she meant? He waved impatiently.
She don't know what she's talking about. She got that all confused.
I shrugged. Well, I hope Mr. Grice is doing all right at any rate. Did he have good insurance coverage? That would be a big help, I'm sure. He shook his head, pulling at his chin.
I don't think he come out too good on that. Him and me has the same insurance company, but his policy didn't amount to much, as I understand it. Between the fire and his wife's being gone now, he's about ruined. He collects disability for a bad back, you know, and she was sole support.
God, that's terrible. I'm sorry to hear that, I said, and then took a chance. What insurance company?
California Fidelity.
Ah, I felt my little heart go pity-pat. This was the first break I'd had. I worked for them. California Fidelity Insurance is a small company that handles all the ordinary coverage, life and health, homeowners, auto, and some commercial lines, with branches in San Francisco, Pasadena, and Palm Springs. Santa Teresa is the home office, occupying the second floor of a 3-story building on State Street, which cuts straight through the heart of town. My corner consists of 2 rooms, one inner, one outer, with a separate entrance. Early in my career, I worked for CFI, doing insurance investigations on fire and wrongful death claims. Now that I'm out on my own, we maintain a loose association. I cover certain inquiries for them every month in exchange for office space. I let myself into the office now and checked the answering machine. The light was blinking, but the tape was blank except for some hissing and a couple of high-pitched beeps. For a while, I had a live answering service, but the messages were usually botched.
I didn't think prospective clients were that keen to confide their troubles to some 20-year-old telephone operator who could barely spell, let alone keep the number straight. An answering machine is irritating, but at least it tells the caller that I am female and I pick up on the second ring. The mail wasn't in yet, so I went next door to talk to Vera Lipton, one of the California Fidelity claims adjusters. Vera's office is located in the center of a warren of cubicles separating adjusters. Each small space is equipped with a desk, a rolling file, two chairs, and a telephone, rather like a little bookie joint. Vera's niche is identifiable by the pall of smoke hovering above the shoulder-high partitions. She's the only one in the company who smokes, and she does so with vigor, piling up stained white filter tips like ampules of distilled nicotine. She's also addicted to Coca-Cola, and she usually has a row of empty bottles marching around her desk, accumulating them at the rate of one every hour. She's 36, single, and she collects men with ease, though none of them seems to suit her. I peered into her cubicle. "What did you do to your hair?" I asked when I caught sight of it. "I was up all night. It's a wig," she said. She stuck a fresh cigarette between her teeth, biting gently while she lit up. I've always admired her smoking style. It's jaunty and sophisticated, dainty and tough. She pointed to the wig, which was streaked with blonde, a wind-blown effect. "I'm thinking of dyeing my hair this shade. I haven't been a blonde for months." "I like it," I said. Her usual color was auburn, a mix of several Clairol offerings that varied in hues from sparkling sherry to flame. Her glasses today had tortoiseshell rims and big round lenses tinted the color of iced tea. She wore glasses so well it made other women wish their eyesight would fail. "You must have a new man in your life," I said. Vera shrugged dismissively, shaking her head. "I got two, actually, but I wasn't up doing what you think. I read a book on how the new technology works, lasers and analog-to-digital converters. I got curious about electricity yesterday, you know? Turns out nobody really knows what it is, which is worrisome if you ask me. Great terminology, though. Pulse amplitude and oscillation. Maybe I'll run into a guy I can say that to. What's with you? You want a Coke?" She had already opened her bottom file drawer, where she kept a little cooler packed with ice. She pulled out a Coke in a bottle about the size of a Playtex nurser and uncapped it by wedging it under the metal drawer handle and giving a quick downward snap. She proffered the bottle, but I shook my head, and she drank it down herself. "Have a seat," she said then, and set the bottle on the desktop with a thunk. I moved aside a stack of files and sat down in the extra chair. "What do you know about a woman named Marty Grice, who was murdered 6 months ago? I heard she was insured through CFI. Vera touched daintily at the corners of her mouth with her thumb and index finger. "Sure, I was assigned to that one. I went out and took a look at the place 2 days after it happened. God, what a mess. I don't have the proof of loss yet, but Pam Sharkey said she'd get it to me in the next couple of weeks." "She's the agent on it?" Vera nodded, taking a drag of her cigarette. She blew the smoke straight up. "The big life insurance policy lapsed, but there was a little $2,500 policy in effect. That's probably not enough to bury a dog these days. There's also a homeowner's for the fire loss, but the guy was desperately underinsured. Pam swears up and down she advised him to upgrade, but he didn't want to be saddled with the added expense. You know how people get. They try to save $6 and end up blowing $200,000-$300,000 when the bottom drops out." She tapped the cigarette on the lip of the empty Coke bottle, neatly knocking the ash into it. "Why's the settlement taking so long?" Vera's mouth turned down, and she lowered one eyelid, a gesture that conveyed the message, "Big deal, though I don't know how." "Who knows," she said. "The guy's got a year to file the claim. Pam says he's been a basket case since his wife died. He can hardly manage to sign his own name." "Did she leave a will?" "Not that I heard. The whole thing's been sitting in probate court for the last 5 months or so, in any event. What's your interest in it? Are you looking into her death?"
Not really. I'm looking for a woman who lived next door when it happened. She left town a couple of days afterward and hasn't been seen since then by the people who count. I keep thinking there's a connection. I was hoping you'd tell me there was a great big policy in effect. The cops had the same idea. Your buddy Lieutenant Dolan was over here practically sitting in my lap for days. I kept saying, forget it, the guy's broke, he's not going to net a dime. I guess I finally convinced him because I haven't heard from him since. What are you thinking? That Grice and this doll next door were in cahoots? It did cross my mind. I haven't met him yet, and I have no idea whether there could have been a relationship between them, but it does look suspect. From what I'm told, she left town abruptly and she was upset. My first instinct was that maybe she'd seen something and took off to avoid getting caught up in it. Maybe so, Vera sounded dubious. But you don't believe it. I'm just looking at his end. If the guy killed his wife for fun and profit, he sure went about it wrong. Why let a policy lapse like that? If he were smart, he'd have jacked the face value up 2-3 years ago, let enough time pass so it didn't look too obvious, and then, whap, his wife is dead and he collects. If he killed her with no payoff, he's an idiot. Unless he just wanted her out of his way. Maybe that was all he cared about. Maybe letting the policy lapse was a ploy. Hey, listen, what do I know? I'm not a homicide dick. Me neither. I'm just trying to figure out why this woman disappeared and where she might have gone. Even if you're right and Grice had nothing to do with it, she still might have witnessed something. This burglar business sounds too tidy for words. Vera smiled cynically. Hell, maybe she did it herself. God, you're more suspicious than I am. Well, you want Grice's number? I got it somewhere here. Vera paused to toss the tag end of her cigarette into the Coke bottle. There was a quick spitting sound as the ember touched the thimbleful of Coke that remained. She extracted a file from the bottom of a stack and found the telephone number and the address. Thanks, I said. She gave me a speculative look. You interested in an unemployed aerospace engineer? He's got bucks. He invented some little dingus they use now in all the satellites. How come you don't want him? I asked. Vera tended to offer up her rejects like hostess gifts. She made a face. He was fine for a while, but now he's on a health kick. Started taking algae pills. I don't want to kiss a man who eats pond scum. I thought you might not object since you live so clean. Maybe you two could jog together and nibble dried seaweed snacks. If you're interested, he's yours. You're too good to me, I said. I'll keep an eye out. I might run into someone who's up for him. You're way too picky about men, Kinsey, she said reprovingly. I'm picky? What about you? Vera stuck another cigarette between her teeth, and I watched her flick a tiny gold lighter into play before she spoke. I figure guys are like Whitman samplers. I like to take a little bite out of each and then move on before the whole box gets stale. Chapter 9. It was 1:30 by now, and as nearly as I could remember, I hadn't eaten lunch. I pulled into a fast food restaurant, parked, and went in. I could have hollered my order into a clown's mouth and eaten in the car as I drove, but I wanted to show I had class. I wolfed down a cheeseburger, fries, and a Coke for $1.69 and was back on the streets again in 7 minutes flat. The house where Leonard Grice was supposedly staying was located in a dingy tract of houses just off the freeway, a neighborhood of winding streets that had been named after states, starting with the East Coast. I rambled down Maine, Massachusetts, New York, and Rhode Island drives, getting stuck in tricky cul-de-sacs where Vermont and New Jersey turned into dead ends. It looked like the builder had gotten as far as Colorado Avenue before the money ran out or his knowledge of geography failed.
There was a long stretch of vacant lots with stakes visible at intervals, each tied with a little white rag to mark off the undeveloped parcels of land. Most of the houses had gone up in the 50s. The trees had flourished, overpowering the small lots. The houses were alternately pale pink and pale green stucco, mirror images of one another, like a whole tray of loaf cakes on a bakery shelf. All had the same rock-covered roofs, as though some volcano nearby had erupted, raining down a thin debris. The whole tract seemed dominated by wide-mouthed garages, and I was subjected to untidy views of lawn equipment and camper shells, toys, tools, dusty luggage, banged-up refrigerators. There were surprisingly few cars visible, and the impression I got was of a community abandoned in the wake of some natural disaster. Maybe a plague had passed this way, or maybe toxic wastes had risen up through the soil, killing all the dogs and cats and burning holes in children's feet. At the intersection of Maryland and Virginia, I turned right. On Carolina, a few enterprising souls had faced their homes with fieldstone or cedar shingle, and some had opted for an oriental effect, trellises of plywood with geometric cutouts that were meant to look Chinese, the roof corners tilted up for that gala 1950s pagoda look. Compared to more recent tracts on the outskirts of Santa Teresa, these houses were shabby, and the evidence of poor construction floated on the surface like chicken fat on homemade soup. There were cracks in the stucco, window shutters askew. The veneer on the front doors was peeling off in strips. Even the drapes were hung crookedly, and I could imagine bathroom plaster bulging out in places, faucet handles frozen with rust. The house had traded their front lawn for a rock garden, apparently burying the scruffy grass under tons of sand, topped with gravel beds in shades of mauve and green. I could still see a strip of black plastic mulch peeping out around the edge where some attempt had been made to suppress the weeds. The Bermuda grass had risen to the challenge, and it was snaking its way through the gravel at a leisurely pace. There was a birdbath tucked among the succulents, and a poured concrete squirrel seemed to pop out of the cactus in an attitude of perpetual stony optimism. I doubted there was a live squirrel within blocks. I parked the car and walked up to the house, taking the clipboard I keep in the back seat of my car. The house garage door was closed, making the place look blank and unoccupied. The long, low line of the porch was obscured with ivy, looking picturesque, but capable, I knew, of lifting the roof right off. The drapes were closed. I rang the bell, but there was no reassuring ding-dong within. A minute passed. I knocked. The woman who came to the door was subdued, her faded blue eyes searching my face hesitantly. "Mrs. Howe?" "I'm Mrs. Howe," she said. It felt like lesson one on a foreign language record. There were dark circles under her eyes, and her voice was as flat and dry as a cracker. "I understand Leonard Grice is staying here, is that correct?" "Yes." I held my clipboard up. "I'm from the insurance company, and I wonder if I might have a word with him." It's a marvel God doesn't reach right down and rip my tongue out by the roots for the lies I tell. "Leonard's taking a rest. Why don't you come back another time?" She was closing the door. "I'll just take a minute," I said quickly. I stuck the clipboard into the crack. She'd never get the door shut that way. She paused. "The doctor still has him on sedatives." A non sequitur, but the point was clear. "I see. Well, of course I wouldn't want to disturb him, but I'd really like to see him, as long as I've driven all the way out here." I tried to sound winsome, but apparently failed. She stared at me stubbornly, and I could see the color rise in her face. She glanced sideways, as though she were consulting an invisible companion. Abruptly, she moved back and let me into the house, with the attitude of someone using the F-word under her breath. Her hair was gray, shoulder-length and thin, turned under in a tight pageboy. She had bangs along her forehead in a hairstyle I hadn't seen since those June Allison movies, where she was so loving and so long-suffering.
Mrs. Howe wore a plain white blouse and a sensible charcoal gray wool skirt. She was chunky through the waist. What is it about middle age that makes a woman's body mimic pregnancy? I'll see if he'll talk to you, she said, and left the room. I waited just inside the front door, taking in with a quick glance the cotton shag carpeting, brick fireplace painted white, an oil painting above it of waves crashing on rocks. She'd apparently used the painting as the focal point of her decorating scheme, because the couch and wing chairs were upholstered in the same passionate shade of turquoise, in a fabric that looked faintly damp. I hated this part of my job, asserting myself persistently into somebody else's pain and grief, violating privacy. I felt like a door-to-door salesman, pushing unwanted sets of nature encyclopedias complete with fake walnut case. I also hated myself vaguely for being judgmental. What did I know about hairstyles anyway? What did I know about waves crashing on rocks? Maybe the turquoise said exactly what she'd meant to say about the room. When Leonard Grice appeared, I could feel my heart sink. He didn't look like a man who'd murdered his wife, as much as that theory appealed to me. He was probably in his early 50s, but he moved like an old man. He was not bad-looking, but his face was pallid, cheeks sunken as though he'd recently lost some weight. His manner was vacant, and he held his hands in front of him when he walked as though he were blindfolded. He had all the airs of a man who has stumbled painfully over something in the dark and wants to be certain he doesn't get caught by surprise again. It was possible, of course, that he'd killed her and was consumed now by guilt and remorse, but the killers I've run into in my brief career are either cheerful or a matter of fact, like they can't understand what all the fuss is about. Leonard's sister walked beside him, her hand near his elbow, watching where he placed his feet. She eased him toward a chair and shot me a look, clearly hoping I was satisfied at the trouble I'd caused. I did feel crummy, I'll confess. He sat down. He seemed to be coming to life, reaching automatically for a pack of Camels in his shirt pocket, while Mrs. Howe perched on the edge of the couch. "Sorry to have to bother you," I said, "but I've just been talking to the adjuster at California Fidelity, and there were a few details we wanted to clarify. Do you mind answering some questions for me?" "He can hardly afford not to cooperate with the insurance company," she interjected peevishly. Leonard cleared his throat, striking a match twice without effect against a paper matchbook. His hands were trembling, and I wasn't sure he'd ever manage to match the flame to the end of his cigarette, even if he could conjure one up. Mrs. Howe reached over, took the packet, and struck the match for him. He inhaled deeply.
"You'll have to pardon me," he said. "The doctor has me on some medicine that does this to me. I'm on disability for my back. What is it exactly that you want?"
"I've just recently been assigned to this case, and I thought it might be helpful to hear your own account of what happened that night."
"What on earth for?" Mrs. Howe said.
"That's all right, Lily," he broke in. "I don't mind. I'm sure she's got her reasons for wanting to know."
His voice was stronger now, dispelling the original impression of feebleness. He took a deep drag of his cigarette, letting it rest in the fork between his index and third fingers.
"My sister's widowed," he said, as though that might explain her belligerence. "Mr. Howe died of a heart attack 18 months ago. After that, Marty and I got in the habit of taking Lil out to dinner every week. Mostly it was a way to keep up with each other and visit back and forth. Well, that night Marty planned to go as usual, but she said she felt like she was coming down with the flu. So at the last minute she decided to stay home. It was Lil's birthday, and Marty was disappointed because she knew we were going to have a little cake brought to the table and waiters singing. You know how they do. She wanted to see the look on Lily's face. Anyway, she felt if she wasn't well, she might spoil everybody's evening, so she didn't go."
He paused, taking a deep drag of his cigarette. He'd accumulated a long ash, and Lily pushed an ashtray toward him just as it tumbled.
"Did you tend to go out the same night of the week each time?" I asked. He nodded. Tuesdays as a rule. I made a note dutifully on the legal pad on my clipboard. I hoped I looked like I had some legitimate reason to be asking all this stuff. I pretended to consult a form or two, flipping back a page. I thought the clipboard was a nice touch. I guess Lily did, too. She peered over, wanting to see me write down something she said, too. "That's the best night for me," she ventured. "I get my hair done on Tuesdays, and I like to go out when it's looking nice." "Hair on Tues," I wrote. "How many people knew you went out on Tuesday nights?" Leonard's eyes slid over to mine with a curious look. The medication had opened his pupils to the full, perfect black holes that looked like they'd been made with a paper punch. "Pardon?" "I wondered how many people knew about your nights out. If the intruder was someone you knew, he might have thought she'd be out with you as usual." His expression flickered with uncertainty. "I don't understand what this has to do with the insurance claim," he said. I had to be careful how I framed my reply, because he'd put his finger on the flaw in my charade. My questions had nothing to do with anything, except trying to figure out if Elaine could have seen a murderer. So far, I didn't even know what had actually happened that night, and I was trying to weasel the information out of him. Lieutenant Dolan wasn't going to tell me, that was for sure. I smiled briefly, keeping my tone light. "Naturally, we're interested in seeing this crime solved," I said. "We may need a determination on the case before the claim is paid." Lily glanced at Leonard, and then back to me, alerted by his wariness. "What kind of determination?" she asked. "I don't understand what you mean." Leonard shifted back to his original attitude. "Now, Lil, it can only help," he said. "The insurance company wants to get to the bottom of this just like we do. The police haven't done anything on it for months." He glanced at me again. "You'll have to pardon Lil." She flashed him a look. "Don't apologize for me when I'm sitting right here," she snapped. "You're too trusting, Leonard. That's what's wrong with you. Marty was the same way. If she'd been a little more cautious, she might be alive today." She faltered, clamping her mouth shut, then surprised me by filling in some details. "She was on the phone to me that night, and someone came to the door. She rang off to see who it was." He chimed in. "The police said it's possible she knew the person, or it might have been someone off the street. Police said a lot of times a burglar rings the bell if the lights are on. If someone answers the door, he can act like he's got the wrong address. Nobody answers, he might go ahead and break in."
"Were there signs of a struggle?"
"I don't think so," Leonard said. "Not that I ever heard. I went through the house myself, but I couldn't see anything missing."
I looked back at Lily. "What had she called about?" I asked. "Or did you call her?"
"I called her myself when we got in," she said. "We got back here a little later than we thought, and Leonard didn't want her to worry."
"And she sounded all right when you talked to her?"
Lily nodded.
"She sounded fine. She sounded just like she always did. Leonard talked to her for a bit, and then I got back on with her, and we were just winding down when she said there was someone at the door and she had to go see who it was. I was going to offer to stay on the line, but we were done anyway, so I just said goodbye and hung up."
Leonard pulled a handkerchief out of his pants pocket and pressed it to his eyes. His hands had begun to shake badly, and there was a tremor in his voice. "I don't even know what her last moments were like. Police said the guy must have hit her square in the face with a baseball bat, something that size. She must have been terrified." He broke off. I could feel myself squirm, but I didn't say anything. What actually occurred to me, as tacky as it sounds, is that a baseball bat in the face doesn't leave time to feel much of anything. Crack, you're gone. No terror, no pain. Just lights out, home run. Lily reached over and placed her hand on his.
"They were married 22 years.
"Good years, too," he said, his tone almost argumentative. "We never went to bed mad. That was a rule we made early. Any time we had a quarrel, we got it settled. She was a fine woman. Smarter than me, and I'm not ashamed to admit it."
Tears glittered in his eyes, but I felt oddly removed, like the only sober person at a party full of drunks.
Did the police mention any possibility of witnesses? Someone who might have seen or heard something that night?
He shook his head, mopping at his eyes.
No, I don't think so. I never heard that.
Possibly someone in the building next door, I suggested, or someone passing by. I understand you've got people across the street from you, too. You'd think someone would have noticed something.
He blew his nose, recovering his composure.
I don't think so. Police never said anything to us.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time, and I'm sorry I've caused you so much distress. I'd like to go through the house and assess the fire damage, if you don't mind. One of our adjusters has already been through, but I'll need to see for myself so I can make my report.
He nodded.
My neighbor has a key. Horace Snyder, right next door. You go knock on his door and tell him I said it was all right.
I got up and held my hand out to him. Thanks for talking to me. Leonard got to his feet automatically and shook my hand. His grip was solid, his flesh almost feverishly hot. By the way, I said, as if it had just occurred to me, have you heard from Elaine Bolt lately? He focused on me, apparently perplexed by the reference.
Elaine? No, why?
I was trying to get in touch with her on another matter, and I realized she lived in that condominium right next door, I replied with ease. Someone mentioned that she was a friend of yours.
That's right. We used to play bridge together before Marty died. I haven't talked to her for months. She's usually in Florida this time of year, I believe.
Oh, that's right. I think somebody else mentioned that. Well, maybe she'll call when she gets back, I said. Thanks again. By the time I got back out to my car again, both my armpits were ringed with sweat.
Chapter 10.
It was now nearly 3 o'clock, and I was feeling frazzled. I'd been up since 2 a.m. with just a brief time out for sleep at dawn before the long-distance call from Mrs. Oxner had wakened me. I couldn't face the office again, so I headed for my apartment and changed into my running clothes. I use the word apartment here in its loosest sense. Actually, I live in a converted one-car garage, maybe 15 feet square, tricked out as living room, bedroom, kitchen, bathroom, closet, and laundry facility. I've always liked living in small places. For months as a child, just after my parents were killed, I spent my spare time in a cardboard box that I filled with pillows and pretended was a sailing vessel on its way to some new land. It doesn't take an analyst to interpret this excursion on my part, but it's carried over into my adult life, manifesting itself now in all sorts of things. I drive small cars, and I favor littleness in any form. So this place suits me exactly. For $200 a month, I have everything I want, including a debonair 81-year-old landlord named Henry Pitts. I peered in his back window on my way out and spotted him in the kitchen rolling out puff pastry dough. He's a former commercial baker who supplements his Social Security these days, doing up breads and sweets, which he sells to or trades with local merchants. I tapped on the glass and he motioned me in. Henry is what I like to think of as an octogenarian hunk, tall and lean, with close-cropped white hair and eyes that are periwinkle blue, full of curiosity. Age has boiled him down to a concentrate, all male, compassionate and prudent and wry. I can't say that the years have invested him with spirituality or infused him with any special wisdom, second sight, profundity, or depth. I mean, let's not overstate the case here. He was smart enough when he first started out, and age hasn't diminished that a whit. Despite the 50 years difference in our ages, there's nothing of the pundit in his attitude toward me, and nothing, I hope, of the postulant in my attitude toward him. We simply eye one another across that half a century with a lively and considerable sexual interest that neither of us would dream of acting out. That afternoon, he was wearing a red rag around his head, pirate style, his tanned forearms bare and powdered with flour, his fingers as long and nimble as a monkey's as he gathered the dough and turned it halfway.
He was using a length of chilled pipe as a rolling pin, and he paused to flour it while he worked, coaxing the pastry into a rectangle. I perched up on a wooden stool and retied my shoes.
"You making Napoleons?"
He nodded.
"I'm catering a tea for someone up the street. What are you up to, besides a run?"
I filled him in briefly on my search for Elaine Bolt while he folded the dough in thirds and wrapped it, returning it to the refrigerator. When I got to the part about Marty Grice, I saw his brows shoot up.
"Stay away from it. Take my advice and leave it to the homicide detectives. You're a fool if you get involved in that end of it."
"But what if she saw who killed Marty? What if that's why she took off?"
"Then let her come forward with the information. It's not up to you. If Lieutenant Dolan catches you messing around with his case, he'll have your rear end."
"Actually, that's true," I said ruefully. "But how can I back off? I'm running out of places to look."
"Who says she's lost? What makes you think she's not down in Sarasota someplace, lapping up gin and tonic on the beach?"
"Because somebody would have heard from her. I mean, I don't know if she's up to something, or maybe in big trouble herself, but until she shows up, I'm going to beat the bushes and bang on pans and see if I can run her to ground."
"Make work," he said. "You're chasing your own tail."
"Well, that's probably true, but I gotta do something." Henry gave me a skeptical look. He opened a bag of sugar and weighed out a mound.
"You need a dog."
"No, I don't. And what's that got to do with it? I hate dogs."
"You need protection. That business at the beach would never have happened if you'd had a Doberman."
That again. God, even my recent brush with death had taken place in a garbage bin. Someplace small and cozy, with me sobbing like a kid. "I was thinking about that stuff today, and you want to know the truth? All this talk about women being nurturing is crap. We're being sold a bill of goods so we can be kept in line by men. If someone came after me today, I'd do it again, only this time I don't think I'd hesitate." Henry didn't seem impressed.
"I'm sorry to hear that. I hope you haven't started a trend."
"I mean it. I'm tired of feeling helpless and afraid," I said. Henry puffed his cheeks up and blew a raspberry, giving me a bored look.
"Big talk," his face said, "but you don't fool me a bit."
He cracked an egg on the counter and opened it up with one hand, letting the white slip through his fingers into a cup. He put the yolk in a bowl and took up another egg, repeating the process with his eyes pinned on me. He said,
"So, defend yourself. Who's arguing with that? But you can drop the rhetoric. It's bullshit. Killing is killing, and you better take a look at what you did."
"I know," I said with less energy. The look in his eyes